We're jumping back into our study of Ecclesiastes. I know it's been a little bit broken up, so I don't know what that's exactly like from your perspective, because from my perspective, whenever I'm here, we're doing it. So we're doing Ecclesiastes, but perhaps it's difficult to remember or have continuity between what we're doing. So we'll just take a brief moment to look back at what we just covered last time, which was the idea of Solomon on this journey, and he's testing himself with pleasure, and then he tests himself with wisdom, and then he examines toil, and in all of it, he finds vanity. And his conclusion in chapter 2, verses 24 through the end, were that there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. And we got cut off a little bit at as we tried to conclude our thought there in 24 through the end of the chapter. But a few things we noted were, one, acknowledge that everything that you have in this life is a gift from the hand of God, and that is your chelek, that is your portion, that's your piece of the pie, right? And so what we're supposed to do in life here under the sun is enjoy the piece of the pie that God has given to you, and not seek to always be making it bigger, not always seeking to get more and get more, because at the end, more is vanity, because you aren't able to keep it or take it with you. But then one thing that we didn't get to look at here at the end, which is significant to what he's saying, is here this idea is the one who pleases God and then the sinner. Okay, so we have Solomon saying here in conclusion that the one who pleases God gets wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But the sinner gets the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. So what we just need to look really quickly at this and identify these two categories of people. Because quite naturally, whenever you see someone who pleases God and a sinner, the two categories that are in your mind are righteous, unrighteous. Correct? That's kind of naturally how we think. But that's contrary to human experience. It's not always that the righteous person gets wisdom, knowledge, joy, and the sinner gets the business of gathering, collecting, only to give to the righteous. Right? That's not really the experience of life, and that's exactly what Solomon is sort of venting about in Ecclesiastes, is that life doesn't always look the way he feels like it should. He's looking at the realities of life. So who are these, what are these two categories? The one who pleases him, the one who pleases God, is essentially the one that God has chosen, okay? The one that it pleases God to give these things to, he gives them to. And then the sinner is the idea of the word is the one who misses, right? So almost if this picture's in your mind of this favor of God or the wisdom and knowledge and joy that God has the ability to bestow, he gives it to some that it pleases him to give it to, and others miss it. The one that didn't get it, he ends up being the gatherer and the collector, only to give to the one who God has been pleased to give something to. Right? So it's almost like these two work environments. It's almost like the CEO versus the day laborer, right? White collar, blue collar almost. And just notice this contrast, and ultimately, what he's kind of laying out, if we're thinking about it from New Testament eyes, is the idea of election, right? That God in his sovereignty has the ability to give whatever he wants to whomever he wants, and he's right in doing so. So going back to the idea of your piece of pie, whatever it was that God gave you, he has every right to give you that exact slice. And you have every right as the creation to say, thank you. This is more than I deserve, right? So that's kind of the idea that's being, the picture that's being painted here. So don't, I guess I was just all that to say, don't think righteous, unrighteous, but perhaps favored or chosen and not favored or not chosen. are the kind of the two categories, not as far as standing before God, but as far as what we receive in this world. Okay, so now what Solomon's going to do is he's going to move on in chapter 3 to the idea of time. So he's examined pleasure, he's examined work, he's examined wisdom, and now he's going to examine time. And as you probably are familiar, these are perhaps, if not the most quoted verses or familiar verses in all of Ecclesiastes. We've all heard, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. We've all heard, he makes everything beautiful in its time. That's probably the most quoted verse from the whole book of Ecclesiastes. And then if you're familiar with the old song, Turn, 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 I actually, on the way here this morning, I was like, hey, can I have your phone? And I turned on Turn, Turn, Turn on the way to church this morning. She's like, what, you need theme music to go to church? And I was like, no, just, I don't know. These people, it's the birds, right? They wrote the old rock and roll song, Turn, Turn, Turn. And it essentially is exactly, it's verbatim, this poem. And then at the end, they add, I can't remember the line that they add, but essentially the whole thing is an anthem for peace. So you get to verse 8, there's a time for war and a time for peace. And I think they say, I swear it's not too late or something like that. Like, we can still have peace. It's kind of what they're going for. But they use this exact poem that Solomon wrote a long time ago. So we're going to look at this. Now, if you remember, actually, I'll just ask, do you remember our kind of our markers, our breaks in the passages that we're looking for in this first half of the book? Do you remember the grammatical phrase that's breaking up our text? It's been a while. It's been a couple weeks, I know. Go back then to the last one. Just go right to the right before chapter 3, because we just had a break before chapter 3, right? What do you see in the last verse? Vanity and, yeah, yep, vexation of spirit, striving after the wind, right? That's our marker. And so the next time that happens is not until chapter 4, verse 4 through 6. It kind of repeats it. There's a repetition there. So that's our next, like, formal break in the text, is chapter 4, verse 6. Well, that's a little bit of a hefty chunk to cover in 1 week. So we're going to try and do it in 2 weeks. And we're going to break today after verse 15 in chapter 3. So we're going to look at Solomon's kind of his thesis or his proposition in verse 1, the poem in verses 2 through 8. And then he has, we'll get there later. But he sort of reflects on this idea of time and then makes some conclusions that we'll look at today. And then we'll transition next week. So let's go ahead and read 1 through 15, and then we'll look into the text. It says, for everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, or perhaps it might even be silent, and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Let's pray and then look closer at this text. Gracious God, thank you for the opportunity to look into your word. We thank you for this book of Ecclesiastes that reflects on life under the sun and gives instruction for not only us, but all of mankind for how they ought to live before you in this time, these short days that we have here on earth. We thank you for it. Ask for insight, both in what I say and what people hear, that you would be pleased in how we live our lives this week, even based on what we learned from Ecclesiastes today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, so he starts out with his proposition, his thesis, verse 1, right? He says, for everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Okay, so that's kind of his ultimate where he's going, what he's saying. He's saying in this giant jigsaw puzzle of life, every piece has its place, right? Or perhaps you could say in the great recipe of life, right? Every ingredient is playing its part. There's a reason and a place and a time for every event that happens. Now, then he goes on to this poem. And really in verse 1, there's no statement of who does this or why it's done or really anything about it. He just makes the statement, right? And then he illustrates it with the poem and then he talks about it more afterwards, okay? So he really is only revealing what he's trying to say piece by piece at a time. It's not all here in verse 1. So then we have this poem 2 through 8. And the way that it's broken up, I mean, it's pretty clear. It's obvious what's going on. There's 14 pairs of events or times that characterize our lives as human beings. So there's 7 sets of them. Each verse is a set. Even in the Hebrew poetry, there's kind of a break at the end of every verse. Okay. Oh, 6, 7, 8. Okay. So there's 7 sets of them, each with 2 pairs of opposites. Now, there have been, even just in studying this week, kind of looking at and interacting with everyone's various propositions of what the structure is and what he's doing or how this is working, and I've not been really convinced by any of it. It's just tricky. If there is a very clear, like, this is what he's trying to say for this reason in the poem, it's just tough. So some people propose... Here's one idea. We'll kind of step through and show you this. So you look at the positive and negative, not just necessarily good or bad, but one is sort of giving and one is taking in every line. So you'd say born is positive, die is negative. Plant is good, pluck up, negative. Okay, so you have plus, minus, and then it's going to switch. A time to kill, a time to heal. Break down, build up. Weep, laugh. Mourn, dance. Okay, so a lot of people would suggest, okay, here's a pair, plus, minus, switch, minus, plus, and then we're going to do the reverse, 4 and 5. Okay, and this one we'll get back to, but theoretically, there's plus, minus, embrace, and then refrain from embracing. Then we're going to switch again, seek, and then lose. We're still going here. Seek, lose, keep, cast away, and then we'll switch. Tear, sew, keep silent, speak. Switch again, love, hate, war, peace, okay? So you've got, you kind of see what's happening. Here's one section, starts this way, ends this way. And then he's gonna switch and do the opposite. Minus plus, all the way through the end of verse 5. Plus minus. Okay, switch again in 6 and 7. Verse 2. And then here's the last one. He goes opposites. Okay, so you kind of see like, okay, that's interesting. That might be true. That I mean, definitely you can see a pattern. You can see what he's doing. There's good and bad in every line, and everyone almost has kind of like a complete idea. But there's some of them that, especially verse 5, it kind of falls apart as far as an official, like, this is what Solomon's doing in his structure for sure. And even if we say, okay, he is, what do we really get out of it? Like, not that much. The point of the poem stands regardless of if you understand, if there's a specific structure or not. So I haven't found that there's a very helpful structure. All that to say, I'm saying nothing. You know, all that talk about structure, we could talk about structure, say, I don't think there's a very clear, helpful structure, at least for the exposition of it, okay? But there's obviously good and bad things going on in each line, positive, negative, give, take, that sort of idea. So notice also, and I just had started doing this recently, I think just the last time we talked, I've already kind of been pre-highlighting each of these slides according to the things we've talked about that are themes, right? So take this page, for example, in 9 through 15, these two pages. Everything that we've already talked about as themes, you know, you have God as a theme or gain and toil. He cannot find is a phrase that'll be later. It's like everything we've kind of talked about is already showing up here. Notice there's none of that in this poem at all. Nothing that he has talked about in the past is really here, and nothing that he's going to talk about in the future is really here. And I think what we take from that is that this is not like, he's just giving examples of things that happen in life in order to get the big picture that this is what life looks like, and there's seasons to life. He could have used different examples. He could have used a different structure. He could have done really whatever he wanted, but the list represents the occasions and situations of life that human beings find themselves in. Good. So what Kara mentioned is that you're still kind of seeing cycles within this, and it's not true of every line necessarily, but you see that pattern throughout that you have like being born and dying, right? And that's cyclical. We want to tie that first line into the first poem that we read about generations, right? And the continuous nature of humanity, and there's nothing you can do about that. So it is a parallel poem because the first one is about the cyclical nature of humanity, and this one's about time in which is wrapped up cycles of humanity, right? So that's a good observation. Okay, so let's kind of jump into each line. And what we want to do is be careful not to be too metaphorical, but to allow it to just say what it's saying, to be literal. Because, for example, if we said the first line is, okay, a time to be born and a time to die, but then we take the second line more as like a metaphor, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Well, metaphorically, that could be speaking of like life and death. And you're like, he already said that. He's pretty much just saying what he's trying to say. He's very plainly giving examples of human life. This is just how it goes, right? These are the cycles. These are the times. These are the seasons. Many of us have experienced many of these. And if you haven't already, you probably will. And probably the older folks are like, yep, seen that, did that. So it's just an example of this is how life goes, and we're going to take it relatively literally. Then we're going to look back at the end after we walk through each of these and say, okay, what should we take? How should we learn from this poem? So, first line, a time to be born and a time to die. Very literally, this is actually not to be born, but a time to give birth, which ties us back to the cyclical nature of generations, like Carol mentioned. There is the season of giving birth, and there is the season of dying. This is probably not worth going into. So grammatically, it's also very reasonable to say, to take all of these as what we call gerunds. So you could say a time for birthing, and a time for dying, a time for planting, a time for plucking up. So, which we'll get to later why that might be significant. So a time to be born, a time to die. That's pretty straightforward, pretty natural. We know what that's talking about. And all of us have seen or experienced that in one sense or another. Then a second phrase of verse 2, time to plant, time to pluck up what is planted. This is talking about gardening or the agrarian society that they're living in, right? There are objectively determined times for planting and plucking, right? We don't get to choose those. We observe them, we learn from them, but if you ignore the rules, then you don't get a harvest. You can't say, well, I'm going to plant mine in the winter and it's going to work. No, why? Because God has already determined a season for planting. So no agrarian society is going to survive, right, without learning the times that God has set. Okay, now we have verse 3, a time for killing and a time for healing. This could be several different things. It could be talking about capital punishment versus like medical treatment, right? There's a time in which to extend the death sentence, and there's a time not to, but to restore. It could also be talking about war, which is alluded to later. You know, there's a time to slay and a time to take to the hospital. It could also be talking about the animal kingdom, even, that there is, you know, a time, an animal's life, where it's time to take that life, right? Many of us have had to even put down animals that we love. Or there's other times that it's you want to help them heal, take them to the vet. There's other times it's not worth it, right? So it could be any of these. We're talking very generally about life under the sun. And there's sometimes, some seasons, that killing is right. And there are other times, other seasons, healing is right. Do we determine those? No, we don't determine them. God's determined them. We observe them, or hopefully observe them. Second half of verse 3, a time to break down and a time to build up. I would imagine that Jeff could probably speak to this, right? As a building instructor or inspector, there's times, right, that it's probably best to take something out, to destroy it, to just, let's redo this. There's other times that it's better to construct, right? Perhaps that's with homes, perhaps that's with commercial buildings, perhaps that's even, eventually we could go back to war again, and we could say sort of a destruction of an enemy and then a reconstruction in the same area. It could be any of those sorts of ideas, okay? So breaking down, building up, or if you think, if you like Chip and Joanna Gaines and what they do, there's always demo day, right? You go into a house that needs to be redone, and then you just take it all out. You rip it all out, the whole inside, the kitchen, you just chuck it, right? And then you begin reconstructing. There's a time for both of those things. Verse 4, the two pairs are very similar and tied together. Time to weep, a time to laugh, and tied in, a time to mourn or a time for grieving, and a time for dance or celebration. Once again, in verse four, you want to think through, are we the ones primarily that determine these times, weeping and laughing and mourning and dancing, or do we more observe them? Like, this isn't a good time for laughing, or this isn't a good time for mourning, right? You kind of have a sense that these times have been established for you and we observe them. So whether this is you could even have an expectation of one and receive the other. Like if you went to a sports game, right, to laugh and enjoy yourself, and then your team loses, it turns into like weeping and mourning, right? You didn't really get to choose, you just observed it. Or more seriously, we had a friend from Iowa not too long ago this past year who she was married, and on her honeymoon, they went out to the beach for the first time. And he had never been out to the ocean, and she was excited to show it to him. And he got out too far, and the current caught him, and he drowned. A time of great rejoicing, right, and celebration turns so swiftly and dramatically to a time of weeping and mourning. She didn't choose that, but she observed it, right? Then we carry on in verse 5. a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. There have been probably of all of the verses, the most ideas on this one, but I think we just take it pretty naturally again. Even think of kind of the idea of a building or the agrarian society again. There's times, like if you're cultivating a field, you want to get all the stones out, right? You don't want any of them. There was one time when I was at Northland and in our extension church, they had a big field out back and they were trying to turn it into like a fun, like soccer field or something for the teens. But it was just a rock field. And so what did we do? Well, we spent some Saturdays casting away stones, clearing the field. And yet there's other times that we need the rocks, right? We're going and finding them and gathering them. Even in the society, you think of perhaps like building a memorial or an altar, or even today, what's that called? Like when you're hiking, Carns? Where you like mark the trail, you know, like you gather stones, put them together, or a time when you're building, you know, and you're trying to assemble the bricks. And so that you just see like there's times to get them out and there's times to bring them in. Similarly, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. I think this is relatively intuitive for us, right? God has ordained a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, and all of us can kind of feel that, right? Like it's the time for a hug or it's not the time for a hug. Learn the appropriate time and place for any particular action, right? And then you have verse 6. And verse 6, the two ideas together kind of work together, a time to keep and a time to cast away. Think of the second word is more like scattering. So perhaps a time like to go to the mall and to look for new clothes. And there's also a time to get rid of some of the clothes that you already have. Right? There's an appropriate time for both of these things, where to go out and look for something new, or to say, no, I actually need to get rid of something I already have. And a similar idea in the next phrase, a time, let's just not even talk about going out to the store, but just looking at what we have. You know, there's a time that we want to keep our closet full or our garage full, and there's other times that it's like, time to make a trip to the Salvation Army, right? Or time to have a garage sale or yard sale. Because you understand just intuitively, and we have to be intentional about what we keep, what we lose. There's times for both of those. And then verse 7, this most likely, 7 as a pair, references the idea of mourning. Okay, so you have a time to tear, as they would in these times, that when they were grieved by something, they would tear their garments, right? And put sackcloth on and ashes on their head. There's a time for that. There's also a time to not to move beyond the pain or the suffering, but in one sense, to take the next step past the phase of mourning, right? Even like as an example, like this last September, Leanna and I had a miscarriage. There's a time and a day to mourn that loss, right? If today I was, you know, walking in, just dragging my feet and I'm just a mess because I'm weeping and weeping, it's kind of like you would just observe. You wouldn't try and be hurtful, but you'd say, it's time to sew. It's time to sew back your garments and to take the next step, right? To continue on. And in that, we have to be careful, right? Because that second phrase probably even speaks to this idea. You think of Job and his friends, or, you know, there's a time to keep silent and there's a time to say something. Perhaps even in this exact scenario, or just generally, which is very true, right? All throughout Proverbs is you just have all over wisdom in when you say and what you say. And then finally, he kind of concludes in this time to love and time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And I intended actually to read a brief excerpt from a book that I read on our retreat, which is called Safely Home by Randy Alcorn. It just illustrates this well, because there's the whole story is written around the idea of persecution, modern day persecution of Christians in China. And Randy Alcorn kind of creatively writes some chapters or sections from the mind of heaven, and even assumes some, but from the mind of God, like what God may be thinking, or Jesus may be thinking or doing or saying in heaven while this is taking place. And it's just very picturesque, because in one scene where someone's being persecuted, God, Jesus has great wrath and anger and hatred even towards the persecution of his people. But then in the same moment, almost, he has great compassion and love and tender care for the one who's being persecuted, right? We understand intuitively that there are times for both of these emotions. And even they play out in live time, right? They play out with war and peace. So we have this whole picture of what's going on in our lives. All these cycles, all of these appropriate times for various things. And so what we have to ask, and this is, I want a little bit of interaction if you don't mind. What we have to ask is, how are we supposed to read this? What are we supposed to take away from this as the main punch? Is it, one, that humans are supposed to determine when it is time for which one of these? Is that kind of the main thing, that there's a time for this and a time for that, and you're called to discern when it's the appropriate time to respond? Kind of this idea of, you know, applying biblical wisdom and discerning how and when and why to do things. Is that the main thing or an appropriate thing to take from this? Or is it better or worse? What do you think? I'm about to ask. Is it better to look at this and say, no, God determines events, and ultimately this is kind of an impersonal poem. Like, it's not actually about my life and doing all of these things, but it's more about like God having set these things in place. I mean, how are we kind of supposed to read this? What are your thoughts on that? Or another idea even that you may have? Yeah, Andrew. Okay. Okay. Good. So kind of a C option. Blend them both together. Okay. So we are supposed to discern the seasons. Okay. Any other thoughts? Agree with those? Disagree? So far, from what we've read or from what we've looked closer at, Solomon hasn't made clear, again, who, what, or why on any of these things. He hasn't even said God sets these yet, right? We're sort of reading that into it. Or he hasn't said you should discern or you shouldn't discern. He hasn't really argued either of them. So let's keep reading and see what Solomon says in our last 5-10 minutes here. So does this verse 9 look familiar? What gain has the worker from his toil? Have you seen that before anywhere? You remember what we call this? This is the main question that Solomon is trying to answer, the programmatic question. He's asked it 2 or 3 times already. What gain has the worker from his toil? What's the point? What do I get? How do I profit from all of my work? And here he's saying, if you keep in mind what I've just said, that all of these things are established, that God has already set times and seasons, right? Because, well, here, we need to keep reading in order to even assume that much. Verse 10, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Okay, now we can say, God's the one that sets these things in place, not you, not me. And some of those are clear, you know, like birth and death. That's okay, God does that. But how about like laughing, weeping? No, God sets those things. He determines when it's good to do these things. And in all of them, verse 11, he's made everything beautiful in its time. So in its appropriate place, in its appropriate season, all of them, and beautiful is not the best way to say this because we have this idea of an aesthetic, right? And we like it. And that's one of the reasons it's the most quoted verse, because it sounds pretty, right? Everything's just lovely in its time. No, everything is fitting. Everything is appropriate. Everything is good. Everything is ordered in its time. That doesn't make it necessarily aesthetically very pleasing, does it? Go back and look at half of the things in the poem. Half of them are no fun at all. War, killing, you know, like it's not necessarily picturesque, but it is right. It's appropriate. It's fitting that God has set these things. So go back to verse 9. It's a rhetorical question. The answer is nothing. There is no prophet, because if God has ordered these things as the sovereign God of the universe, and he's the one that says, this is how it's supposed to go, I'm going to order your times, then what are we doing scurrying about, being busy about our work when it's already set? Like, we can't, again, going back to the beginning of Ecclesiastes, we can't affect the cycle. We can't disrupt the cycle. Our life is going to look like all the other lives of all the other people, in one sense, that we are going to be born, we're going to experience some of these things, and we're going to die. So what's the profit? There is no profit in all of my work. So what should I do in that kind of a world? Well, let's finish this first. So programmatic question, verse 9, and then he says, I have seen. So he's going to make some observations, right? And the observation is some of what we just mentioned, is that God's the one who's busied the children of men with these things. God is the one who's made everything fitting. He's sovereign. He's the one that says when something is suitable and right and proper and good in its own season. And then also, he's done something else. He's put eternity into man's heart, yet in such a way that man cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Okay, so we need to talk briefly about this. What is the idea of God putting eternity into men's heart? Do we have other translations here today of eternity? World. It's going to be the King James world. Any others? Okay, there's several other ways that people translate this. One of them is he has put toil into man's heart, which you construct that by respelling the word eternity. Okay, you get world with a, it's a post-biblical meaning of the word. It was used in the Septuagint, and it was used in the Vulgate, but that meaning was not associated with this word until after biblical times, okay? Then you have others say knowledge, which is essentially, they're taking the Hebrew word as the hapax legomena, meaning it was only used once, as a construction from two Aramaic words, a noun for knowledge and a verb for know. And they're saying, okay, if you look at the Aramaic of these two words and sort of blend them together, you kind of get the spelling of this Hebrew word, which must mean this is the only time that Hebrew word is used. So we have knowledge, okay? Or you just take it as eternity. And it's not the only time that Kohelet uses the word eternity. There's probably about eight other times. We don't have time to look at them all. But in them, it's consistent that he's talking about that which endures, that which is eternal, that which is timeless exactly, but goes beyond time. It's past and future. And ironically, he's saying he's put this idea of time and something beyond the present. We have the past and the future in our minds, and we know that it goes beyond a long ways in both directions. We have that idea, but not so much that we can understand what God's doing with it. Not so much that we can answer all of the questions that we want to answer, which is, what's God doing in the beginning, and what's God doing in the end? Or what is he doing with all of these seasons, and why did he appropriate them this way, and how can I figure it out? And he's saying, that's not yours to know. That's for God. And he's given you this tension in which you get something about it, but you don't fully understand it. Now, why would he do that? Now we're going to have two, we got to wrap up here. There's two perceptions, two conclusions that Kohelet makes. One is the same thing we talked about 2 weeks ago. He says, okay, well, if that's the case, then I may as well just live. I may as well just be joyful and do good as long as I have breath. I may as well eat, drink, take pleasure in my toil, because that's what God gave me to do. That's my piece of the pie, right? And we're not going to spend time on that simply because we've talked about it a little bit before, and we'll talk about it again. And then his second perception, second conclusion, is the most significant for this section, that whatever God does endures forever. Same word, eternity. Okay, so there's this idea of it goes beyond the now. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. Verse 15, that which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. So you have this idea of, okay, God's the eternal one. God's the one that's determined these things. We can do nothing about it. And regardless of what we do, his purpose is established. There is a time to plant. There is a time to pluck. God's determined that already. Now, why did he do it? And here's where we got the punchline is this. I agree with Andres, right? We should read this poem in multiple ways. We should read it primarily as God's established these things and I can't actually understand them. That's the first thing and the main thing that Solomon's saying. The secondary is appropriate. So yeah, we should with wisdom seek to evaluate and understand when it is proper for these things to take place. But that's not what Solomon's saying, because he's already applied wisdom. And what did he find? He found it lacking. So he's not saying, look at all these things God set. Now take your wisdom and go find them. No, he actually says you can't find them. You won't know. You won't understand, because God's not given that to you. And so, sure, it's a great parenting poem. And it really is. I mean, it's a great way to teach your children. There's an appropriate time for various things that God set in place. And we should use wisdom to evaluate them. But ultimately, wisdom is going to lead us to a place where we understand only what's lacking. We're going to understand there's things we don't know. And ultimately, here is what God is trying to say by setting these seasons in his sovereignty. Why did he do it? He did it so that people would fear him. He did it because he knows more than you. He did it because he's greater than you, and you've got to live with that. Your wisdom can't get you to the point that you understand why he's doing all these things. Your wisdom, like our friend in Iowa, her wisdom won't help her understand why her husband's gone. But if she fears God and trusts that he's the sovereign one who did that in her life, then she has the proper response. She's on her knees, right? She's not just in her mind trying to figure it, because God gave her a portion of it, but not enough to fully understand. So the whole point of this idea of time is that this should bring us to a point of humility, that God set these things in place, and we need to be willing to live life graciously accepting whatever he gives us, and willing to say, he's the sovereign one. I am not. He knows these seasons. I do not. So they're going to come into my life, and I'll seek to be wise about it, but that's all I can do. So we're out of time. If we have questions, we can talk about it more in the coming.